lunch in this room as well. Not quite as nice as the...
I know. I don't know what happened.
Bye.
All right, we're going to get started in a couple in 30 seconds. Nikki's going to start speaking. So you'll miss it if you're not paying attention.
30 seconds, huh?
It's amazing how fast things can get together once people are determined, but they don't seem to be very determined. Don't make me name names.
Ken raised it already.
Wait, say that again?
Huh?
Say that again?
I said Ken raised the idea.
I know.
Okay, so the next item on the agenda is a briefing from... from Nikki Karpovich from the Idaho Public Utility Commission staff about the fact that there is a docket at the Idaho Commission filed by the Idaho Power to suspend its demand response programs. And this is an open docket. Ken and I appreciate Nikki's willingness to come and lay out the particulars. We're not going to be able to discuss the docket. However, I think Ken and I wanted to have this on the agenda because this is one of those things that starts to happen when a good idea starts to get implemented, is that you start to see in a maturing way some of the things that can happen that you don't necessarily expect. And so the brief conversation we will be able to have after Nikki finishes is really more about how demand response matures and deals with what events come and that things like the Idaho Power docket are among those things that come. So, Nikki, please, thanks for being here, and you're on.
All right. Again, my name is Nikki Karpovich. I'm at the Idaho PUC as a utilities analyst, and I'm going to preface this by saying anything I say does not insinuate my opinion or position. All right. With that, we have three regulated electric utilities, Avista, Idaho Power, and Rocky Mountain Power. Idaho Power and Rocky Mountain Power are the two utilities who have DR programs, and they are summer peaking utilities. With that, the two open DR filings that we have actually concern both of these. And because these are open dockets, as a participating party, as other people who might be participating in these who are listening, discretion is required. And this is not an open discussion, and anything that I present to you today is something that is already on the record. So with that, I'll just go ahead and start with Rocky Mountain Power. And they have an irrigation load control program, two different schedules. One is a pre-scheduled and one is a dispatchable program. And collectively, Rocky Mountain Power has, in 2012, 246 megawatts of capacity. They did have an average realized load reduction of 139 megawatts, and they called their program 12 different times this past year. In December, Rocky Mountain Power, they filed to approve a new DSM contract. They would like to cancel their DR tariffs and approve a new contract with an aggregator. And this aggregator has the full responsibility for the installation, O&M of devices, dispatching the devices, customer recruitment service, 10-year contract, and a payment based on the average load availability. So what happens from this point forward, we had a pre-hearing conference, and there has been a stipulation filed between the irrigators and Rocky Mountain Power. Next, all the parties are going to continue to analyze the contract. We'll put together a comment period, followed by commission decision. The next one that we're dealing with is something that was already alluded to with Idaho Power. And Idaho Power has three DR programs, and collectively it's about 400 megawatts of capacity. We have the Irrigation Peak Rewards Program, started in 2009. We have an AC Cool Credit Program for residentials in 2003. And the Flex Peak Management Program, industrial, commercial, began in 2009 and is set to expire in 2014. With those AC Cool Credit Program, in 2011, the company had about 38,000 participants, with an average peak demand of 24 megawatts, and we had 14 events called.
For the excuse me, Nick.
Say that again on the phone?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you have slides with this, but we're not seeing any slides.
Oh, no, it is a verbal presentation. Do you get
the, okay, thank you.
For the Irrigation Peak Rewards Program, the company has about 2,300 participants with a capacity of 320 megawatts. And the program was not called at all last in 2011. Now, what the company did file for in December was the temporary suspension of two of these two programs for 2013. What happened is the company has determined through their 2013 IRP load and resource balance that no capacity is needed until 2016. And so that's no peak hour deficits. And through this process, the company looked at their existing resources, their transmission capacity, and their energy efficiency programs, along with economic growth that's forecasted. The company has requested stakeholder involvement to determine and identify relevant issues going forward. So on a regulatory front, what we're going to do is we've already had a pre-hearing conference. Some settlement negotiations have occurred. There will be a comment period followed by a commission decision. And that is the extent of my presentation.
Thank you, Nikki. So, as I said, the reason we wanted to talk about this was not to dive into the merits of the case. We can't really do that. But to talk about, to the extent that you want to, anything about, you know, how events that can come up over time, alternatives that the utility might be bringing along, cause demand response programs to ebb as well as flow. And so I think with that, if you want to engage on that topic, that the floor is open.
Robert Maritz, I'm wondering if the superabundance of wind power that Idaho Power is getting, that you're being required to take, not you, but the utility, is what is forcing a second look at the demand response programs? Is that partly what's involved here?
I'm not going to comment on that. Okay.
So that's accepted.
That's out of bounds. Or as they said at NARUC, Voldemort.
Robert is referring at NARUC to the fact that somebody wanted to have a meeting about Order 1000, in which Order 1000 from FERC could not be discussed, so somebody decided to call it Voldemort and then proceeded to talk about it. But we won't put Nikki in that spot because this is a friendly crowd.
Without knowing anything about it, really, beyond what I just heard, I would guess that wind isn't the problem because we generally don't get peak capacity out of wind, I mean, in the summer or the winter. So I would think that their decreasing need for DR is not a matter of wind. It's a matter of load, and it's a matter of other generation, the generation that can actually, you know, produce at peak. So
Jeff on the phone.
Go ahead on the phone.
Jeff Carr here.
Question, is Idaho Power asking for suspension of all three programs?
No, to clarify, it is two of the three, the AC Cool credit and the irrigation program. The commercial industrial program is under an aggregator and is under contract until 2014, early 2014.
And I'm gathering, Nikki, that they haven't said anything about after that time because they haven't had to, and so that, and that's not part of this docket. Is that correct?
We're going to look at everything.
Okay. Okay. That's a clarification.
I think the interesting, I mean, the interesting thing, and Idaho has actually been, has been illustrative, I think, once before about, they came in and they talked in a previous pin drop meeting about some discussion they were having for reshaping their incentives for their customers. And that's, I think what's interesting about this is it shows us, as Rich kind of said, as DR actually starts being used, it's actually performing, you know, things that we need. Just like any other resource, conditions change. If Idaho Power was meeting all its peaks with a bunch of simple cycle turbines, and it turned out that their loads didn't increase as fast as they thought and so forth and so on, they wouldn't have this option. You know, Ken Nichols referred earlier to the fact that if you got iron in the ground, you got to keep on paying for it. You don't have to run it, but you still got to keep paying, you know, the capital cost. So the question is it? I think what we're going to be looking at as this plays out and others is just how flexible DR is. It is flexible. It doesn't have a great deal of first investment, but it does have some investment. You set up programs, you establish relationships with your customers, and you don't want to jerk them around too much because maybe not this year, but 3 years from now, you may need that relationship again. So I think that's what's interesting about this, and you don't have to know the specifics of the Idaho situation to be interested in it.
So going back to the wind question, which you can't answer, but I guess I would ask, are any of the utilities that you oversee looking at demand response programs that might be able to assist them with the overgeneration situation from wind? And if so, is there an estimated time where they think they might be able to roll out such a program?
That's not something I could discuss. I'm trying to keep everything within the bounds of
okay. Acceptability. Okay.
Ken?
Yeah, on the phone?
Yeah, this is Jeff Bumgarner with Rocky Mountain Power. Couple thoughts. First, on the flexibility, you know, shutting it off for 2 or 3 years, as you mentioned, Ken, one of the things that's a challenge to that is that, like you say, there's a customer component to it who works programs into their economics and participating, as well as the fact that a lot of the control equipment, depending on the DR program, still needs to be maintained. And one of the things that we've found, especially on equipment like irrigation, it's very similar to cell phones. The equipment has a shelf life. Technology and control equipment right now has a shelf life of seemingly like 3 or 4 years. And so that also makes it kind of, there is flexibility, I think, in that, you know, you may be able to shut it down, but you want to make sure that you're not going to need it for a foreseeable future if you're going to do that. And you probably are in a situation where maybe it's just a season that it's going to happen, and you're not going to have that equipment issue that you're going to have to deal with later. But if you turn it off for too long, everything goes to seed. We saw that in our irrigation program that we had run for years and years, and then when we needed it in 2001 to turn it back on, lo and behold, a lot of the equipment was not usable. Frequencies weren't available. Equipment was either broken or antiquated. And so there was some challenges. Now, we hadn't relied on it in several years, so it's not a complete comparison to, for instance, what Idaho Power's, you know, facing, where they're talking about at least a one-year suspension.
Ken?
Yeah.
This is Frank Brown up in Seattle, Bonneville. I think I'll just say what my observation is. I think they had an earlier IRP that showed that with the load growth that was occurring in the middle part of the 2000s, which was, you know, Idaho was one of the fastest growing states in the nation, especially down in Boise and the Idaho Power Service area, that their peaks were going to increase so much that they needed both a combustion turbine and DR. And so they began the process of building their new combustion turbine, as well as implementing their very successful DR programs. And now low growth.
Yeah. Rich and I, Frank,
came online.
Frank, I'm sorry. Rich and I both are feeling like this is getting too, we really promised we would not get into the specifics of this situation. You know, it's of interest in general.
Well, I guess I'm just saying that the DR isn't really getting a bump because the DR was ineffective.
Oh no, and I don't. I never had that impression.
And I think it's important to note that they built a new combustion turbine.
If a hypothetical utility did that, that would be significant. and we'll stop there. Sorry. I'm sorry.
One more point. I think this is relevant. Hypothetical situation. This is Bruce Pearlstein from Navigant. Even if you have enough steel in the ground to meet expected peak demand with your appropriate reserve margin, it's still a question of whether the DR program is more cost-effective than the use of existing capacity. And you can compare the going-forward fixed costs of the existing capacity to the costs of using the DR program. And if the latter is less than the former, it makes sense from an economic perspective to continue the DR program. Most of the time, we assume the DR programs avoid new capacity. That doesn't have to be true, but the standard against which you're judged for cost-effectiveness changes when you have enough existing capacity to meet your peak.
The fixed costs have to be avoidable.
Yes.
And if, you know, the capital costs aren't, they're on the hook. Okay. If there are some that aren't sunk, but, in, yeah, okay. Okay.
Okay, I think that was stressful enough. I think this will come up again, and of course the Idaho Commission will act, and we'll see what they do. But I think this is just elevates an interesting vector of this conversation about ability of the programs, customer relationships, value basis. So a number of issues come up in this, and we wish Nikki well in figuring this out. Okay, so we're going to move on to the next
Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks a lot. Ken, do you want to introduce this?
The Oregon PUC has. The Oregon PUC is asking for some information about flexibility needs and flexibility prospects by utilities in their IRPs. And Jim is here to tell us about that. And the reason I think it's relevant to DR is because of DR 2.0, the possibility of DR providing some of these flexibility services. And now, you know, I think it's becoming pretty widespread in appreciation for the fact that we may be running short of that. We've got, you know, we have all this renewable to integrate and so forth. So without taking more of Jim's time.
How much time do you have?
15.
Okay. And the reason I'm a private citizen is that I'm no longer working in the commission, but helped with writing the these IRP guidelines. Okay, and since I'm no longer there, unlike Nikki, I also have a disclaimer, but mine is going the other direction. Any views expressed here are mine and mine alone, and may or may not reflect the views of the commission staff, or anybody else. So I get to say what I think. And I wanted to wish everybody happy Valentine's Day. And we'll have a little quiz at the end of the presentation, so listen up. The guidelines themselves are fairly simple. These were issued about a year ago in a somewhat unrelated decision, but the idea was to bring into the IRP process the notion of flexibility and moving it toward that. You know, for 30 years we've been looking at energy and capacity, and what became apparent to us is we got to start looking at the whole flexibility issue. And so how do we do that? Well, just like we've been doing for 30 years, let's look at how much, ask the utilities to report on how much flexibility they have, project what their needs would be, and let's see what the delta is. Then the second piece said, okay, what are all the different ways you can meet that flexibility requirement? Let's get them on the table. Let's look at them on a comparable basis. Now, there's a lot of devils in those details, but it's the thread of discussion about flexibility that's woven all through what we've been hearing this morning and yesterday. Oops, sorry, I'm supposed to be changing it.
I can.
Okay.
Is this where you want to be?
That's where I want to be. The reasons for this ascendancy of flexibility, there's no secrets here. Increasing net load variability, the emergence of new tools, including demand management, which is, to me, I wish the discussion could move to that term. Management, to me, implies more that you're really in control. You're not just trying to elicit a price response or something, but you actually have control of it. And then, again, the whole issue of planning. The commission interest here, if for me to put my own spin on it, but I think this is what the commission was thinking, was they don't want to get in a position where, as the flexibility need becomes apparent and you, all of a sudden you have a crisis, you've got to do something, then you have one more CT and one more CT and one more CT. And that might be the answer with low gas prices and relatively inexpensive technology. That may, in fact, be the answer, but they don't want to just go blindly forth with that as a solution. No secrets here. Net load variability. The thing that becomes apparent to me is that this net load variability, it's different than things have been. I divide it into three pieces here: the frequency, the amplitude, and duration. Of variable energy resource variability precludes a single or a simple solution. We need to be looking at what are all the different things that can help with the situation, and then get real smart about fitting them together into some sort of a comprehensive plan and moving forward. The bullet point, the sub-bullets here, continuous short-term production variability puts a premium on the speed and accuracy of response. If any of you are sort of following this at the FERC level, there was an order a year or so ago where the FERC, I think in PJM, they ordered a higher rate to be paid to those flexibility resources that were faster responding. They referred to a higher quality of response. Well, they're talking flywheels and batteries, basically, or whatever else. They're sort of technology agnostic. But if you can respond to a frequency signal quicker, faster, better, more accurate, then you should be paid more. So that's kind of the notion there. the fast and large magnitude ramps of especially, well, wind, but it could be solar, may or may not align with load ramps, and then extended periods of low and no generation. So you have sort of this mix of variability all trying to get managed. So that's what we were looking at in writing these guidelines. We've pretty much talked through that other stuff. Okay. And I didn't want to... Everybody's got to put up some kind of BPA data. This is 5-minute BPA data from the month of January 2011. I just picked a month and put it together. Each day has its own color. And what I take away from this is even on a good day, there's lots of short-term variability to be managed. And so how are you going to do that? Then some more BPA stuff, you know. These are easy to capture off the web. But I thought, you know, I got a couple here that I thought were sort of interesting. This is from October. And you see... basically pretty flat wind until that, what, sixth day of the week, and then you get a tremendous ramp up sort of midday. At the same time, the hydro system, it has lots of flexibility to bounce up and down and is basically doing all the absorbing the variability. And that brown line, which is the thermal, they're just clicking along and a nice flat line. Now, contrast that with a springtime shot, and you've got hydro much less, you know, it moves around, but it has much less flexibility to move, little better wind production, and then you've got the thermals absorbing variability. So the planning, it's not one problem or another, it's a whole bunch of problems all coming together. And, you know, depending on where you are seasonally, can make a real difference. Just wanted to talk a little bit about how flexibility sources, you know, what are the things that a utility, the commission would expect a utility to come in and to be showing, talking about. And this is my list. Diversity. The ability to move across broader geographic or technological landscape, presumably you'll get some benefit there. On the generation side, the fast responding hydro, CTs, and reciprocating engines can do the job. If you do a lot of this variability management with the thermal plants, there's this wear and tear factor, and the response range is a fraction of the nameplate, and again, you're looking at potentially degraded fuel heat rates or degraded emissions performance. Storage, which is kind of my favorite, has some advantages and certainly has some disadvantages. We've been hearing about those. It's expensive and it's seen as very exotic and in some cases difficult. I think the industry will get through that as when gas prices come up a little bit. I think we're going to start seeing other technologies kind of move in and be able to occupy some of the space. And then lastly, and not, certainly not least, was the whole notion of demand management. I don't know this field real well, but my sense is that there's a tremendous potential. And I applaud all of you for, you know, being on, you know, looking at the possibilities here. I think that's it. Oh, it is. Yeah. Oh, yeah, here's the quiz. What's the piece of flexibility that we have not talked about that's coming down the road? Okay. I'm sorry?
The ability to go up.
No, I'm everything I said, I'm talking up and down. Well, I would include them on the demand side. Yeah, I mean.
So the audience is saying vehicles.
Managing. I'll give you a hint. I cut my energy teeth at a pipeline. Natural gas. This is an issue that's sort of you're starting to hear more about it, and I'll say this: it's not a trivial issue. I mean, the gas industry always feels taken for granted because it's basically been fairly reliable, and they have enough capacity to handle things. But the ability of the gas system is not unlimited, just like the hydro system. You know, we had years and years. We thought, oh gosh, there's lots of flexibility. We can just use the hydro there. Well, BPA has clearly demonstrated that there are limits there, and there are physical limits to what the gas system can do. And I'll just throw in my little anecdote. When somebody asked me to compare the two. Electricity moves at the speed of light, and your problems are right here and right now, and you know you got to fix it now. Gas moves at the speed of gas, which is about 15 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour. So if you got a problem today, help might be 3 or 4 days away, depending where you're getting your gas. So it's another piece of flexibility that it's starting to get onto the table a little bit, but I would encourage you to keep your eyes on that. So,
are there other? Sure. Okay.
Yeah, Jim, you make a great point. Anyway, you got it. You got to have storage, and you know when I was speaking, I talked about pumped hydro or batteries, which are kind of two different ends of the same issue, as you point out. But if it's gas, you're going to have. You've got to have gas storage, as you know. So, anyway, you got it. It's storage.
Right. I've thrown some other slides on the back of here that you can read at your leisure. The point on storage, you can't throw it all in just one basket. I mean, there's the short-term storage, flywheels and batteries, basically, although the batteries are getting to be longer and longer as the technology improves. And then there's the bulk storage, the old-fashioned pumped hydro, but it's no longer old-fashioned. They've got, they've made improvements on the equipment that they're installing here and the controls, so they're much faster than they used to be in terms of responsiveness. So, again, it's like lots of different problems, and we've got building blocks to solve them, but it's, you know, how do we fit them all together? So.
Do you feel that flexibility is sufficiently defined? I think yesterday we had a presentation, and I think you mentioned sort of three dimensions of flexibility, the magnitude, the ramp rate, and the duration. And
right.
I was sort of shocked when we had a presentation when I worked here at the council from Bonneville, learned that they intentionally put delays in the controls on the hydro system so it doesn't respond too quickly. That it could, in terms of megawatts per minute, that didn't seem to be an issue, but it was more the magnitude, maybe over many minutes or hours, that was the bigger issue.
I'm far from an expert on all of that.
I can just say something about that, and it'll come up in the presentation I'm going to give next, that I think this is an issue. One of the things I'm going to tell you in a minute is that perhaps our roster of ancillary services is incomplete and that it needs to talk about ramp rate and cycling frequency.
Yep.
And that, one can say that, and it sounds like a sensible thing, perhaps, as we think about integrating renewables. But the each control area thinking about defining that, the worst case would be a lot of different definitions around the United States. So I think where we're really headed with that is that FERC is seeing this as an issue, and is going to hopefully try to help us as they define the ancillary services that we now have in Order 2000, I think, over 10 years ago, perhaps they'll help us with that and create some standards around what that's called. Because relying on the RTO governance processes or the individual control areas to come up with their own definitions of that could have dire consequences in terms of larger balancing areas and systems working together on renewable integration challenges.
Let me just amplify on that just a little bit. You were there for the presentation yesterday afternoon I thought that's a great piece of work, and it's moving, trying to answer those questions of how do you define this whole flexibility thing, and how do you get your hands around it? And then the other question is, how do you measure, what are the metrics going to be?
Measure and verify it, too.
Right. And then that can extend into the question of ancillary services. Maybe there are different grades of balancing services. I don't know. I'm making all this up. But there is work going on the question of metrics. I know EPRI is working on it. They've got some sort of a program going on metrics. And I think NERC, through the task force they've got with the incredibly long acronym, about variable generation integration task force and so forth, I think they've got like a subcommittee of a subcommittee that is doing nothing but looking at this whole metric and flexibility measurement question. It has to get solved in some way, because we can all, everybody can do their own thing, and that's kind of what we're doing so far. But at some point, to make it rational, we're going to need to get to those definitions and settle on some techniques. I mean, that's the other thing. I compare this question is a little bit behind. There's in also as part of the IRP process, there are these wind integration studies. And the early ones were pretty rough and ragged, and because nobody had done them, and it's computationally difficult, and you got to scratch your head and think, is this a fair way to do this? And over time, you can see them how it has settled down, and the industry has come to something of a standard. It's not exactly standardized, but they're moving toward it. So I would anticipate a similar kind of progression with the whole flexibility question and metrics and so forth.
Any other questions for now from the phone?
I want to know if I understand you correctly also. Are you saying that there needs to be also more coordination between the folks working on storage issues and the folks working on demand response, for instance, and how it's going to integrate? Or is it already happening or not?
There needs to be more. In my view, and like I said, I'm not much of a – I have not followed demand response, demand management issues in the whole – this world. But I see demand response as yet another tool for flexibility. And I think under that, it's like an umbrella. And all these things are under the umbrella, and how do we fit them together and use – how do we use them? I think so – what I've seen so far, DR has kind of been on its own track for many years, really. And I think, sort of this whole reemergence of storage is relatively new. So, yeah, more coordination, more thinking, bringing the DR people more firmly into the IRP process is maybe a way to go. I don't know.
Okay, I burned up all my time.
You did.
That's fine. Thank you. That was good.
So we're going to lead into lunch with a short talk from me about some recent work that the Regulatory Assistance Project has done as Ken is queuing up the PowerPoint.
You're on here.
The issues that we've been talking about relating to integrating renewables is something that RAP has been working on in Europe, actually. And so this paper that this is drawn from, What Lies Beyond Capacity Markets, was actually done for the folks in Germany. But we realized that in places like Texas, where there's 8.5% wind in terms of annual energy, in California, where there's quite a lot of wind also, and in other parts of the U.S., and it sounds like the Pacific Northwest is among those, these issues are coming and coming quickly. So I think this tries to bring together some of the things that we've already been talking about to integrate into planning these new issues about responsiveness as we get more variable resources, issues about responsiveness without undermining whatever market structures we have, and trying to avoid making decisions that are incompatible with where the future is going by creating investment signals and by basically accepting that we're driving towards significant renewable energy for reasons that include climate and other public interest, we want to have the integration costs for those renewables be reasonable. And so thinking about reliability and its two significant portions, resource adequacy and stability, or having enough capacity and then being able to operate the system successfully, we need to think about timescales. The timescales for operations have traditionally been short, thinking about how to operate the system with the facilities that we have available, with the functionality that those facilities offer. So basically thinking about ancillary services as drawing them from the resources that happen to be around. And I think that one of the messages in this work is that perhaps people who oversee the power sector in all their different roles should think about how to drive investment towards resources that provide operational flexibility, and to think about lengthening the time scale that we think about this in. So instead of just taking the resources that happen to be around, driving investment and creating longer-term forward signals to drive investment towards the kinds of flexible resources we've been talking about this morning. Now, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on capacity markets because that's not a big deal here. But in some places, people think about this as, are we thinking about energy markets or capacity markets? And the title of the paper, What Lies Beyond Capacity Markets, is meant to get people out of thinking it's a binary choice between having an energy market and a capacity market. We can motivate investment in the direction of flexible resources in either way, as long as there's a commitment to do that. So I wanted to show you these two pictures. This picture is a picture of gross demand. It happens to be a forecast of the German system in 2030, but it can represent gross demand of pretty much any system over the course of a year, and relate that to what happens if there's a lot of wind on that system. And I think they're planning on having a lot of wind in Germany in 2030. And so these are the same systems. So the same simulation, same result, but measuring what happens with gross demand and net demand after you've taken out all of the wind and solar that is expected to exist. And what this is intended to show somebody who's just sort of wading into this issue, and many of you have long since started wading into this issue, is that the ramping and cycling challenges in a system like this, where basically you're saying, we're going to accept all the wind and solar, and we're going to expect the rest of the resources to deal with it. And so this is what the rest of the resources have to deal with, is some hours where there's very, very low loads, and some hours where there's very high loads, and moving quickly, in some cases, between high load and low load states at any time during the year, during peak months and low load months. Those characteristics are going to be necessary. There's a question.
Is there a question?
Which Ken, I'll repeat the question instead of asking Ken to run around.
What percentage of penetration, renewable variable penetration?
I think this is around 40%. This is the question was what percentage of renewable penetration is this scenario, and I think the number is in the 40s someplace. So is this suggests a challenge? And it's important, I think, to recognize that this is a challenge and that there are many possible options, and some of them can mess you up. So if the idea is to deal with capacity issues by creating more inflexible resources, that's not a good thing. Another option that people talk about in Texas these days is increasing the cap on energy prices to some very, very large number. To us at RAP, that suggests that we're going to expect the generators trying to make their profit for the year to hope for really awful crises, that energy prices in the spot markets can go up to incredibly large numbers, and that's the only way they're going to be profitable. So from a public interest standpoint, that sounds crazy, because if you really want to promote a crisis in order to allow generators to make money, that sounds like you're substituting one problem for another. So creating a situation where you're motivating the kind of investment in resources that are in harmony with a grid that has a lot of renewables, instead of sending investment in other directions, is part of the message here. So our suggestion is to think about modifying markets, either energy only or capacity markets, with price signals that are associated with products that are oriented towards providing ramping and cycling. And it's important, I think, to use the word functionality here. There's been a lot of conversation here, including from the last talk about the different sources of flexibility. And I think for control air operators to think about articulating the functions that the grid is going to need, creating investment signals to draw out those functions from wherever they're most economic, and let the great technology minds that we have in all the different possibilities compete to find those. One of my colleagues at RAP used to work in the gas generation business, and just to follow up on the gas thing, I understand that the gas generators have a choice. They can either construct as they usually do to minimize the running cost, or for some amount equivalent to roughly 15 or 20% of capital cost, they can maximize flexibility. They'll be slightly more expensive to run, but they may possibly be more valuable to the grid if they've maximized flexibility. So the question for a generator like that, and really any gas generator is a generator like that if they have a new project in their thinking, is why would they do that if there's no longer term value suggested by whoever is running the market to pay them for that flexibility value? And I think this is increasingly going to become of interest to regulators who are trying to square the circle here about how to adapt their oversight to a grid that is increasingly dominated by renewable energy, and how do they signal to the generators that are under their control, either because they're vertically integrated companies building these generators, or because they have some role in guiding in-state planning that indicates whether merchants are going to come or not. Is what kinds of values is the utility going to pay for? So forward contracting of ancillary services in an energy-only market, which is probably what we're talking about here, elevates the net demand objective. And I think I'm going to skip the forward capacity market thing because that's not terribly relevant, but I will show you these pictures. This is if you had a capacity market, how a capacity market would clear if you didn't care what kind of capacity it was. And if you, on the other hand, decided that you had three different kinds of capacity, the kind with the steepest supply curve on the left being ones that are most valuable to the grid, and in at least one view would be emphasizing high degree of value in ramping and cycling, those would get paid more than tranches that had less capability in those areas. And we have in the paper a way of thinking about whether you what you might want to do in terms of making decisions. But I think the simple message that you can get from looking at this paper, and I brought a small number of copies, but this is how you can find it online as well as an associated paper that is a lot less picturesque and more oriented toward Europe, is to just take many of the conversations we've been having today and for us to push ourselves out of the energy and capacity paradigm and to think increasingly about the often overlooked area of ancillary services as perhaps not just an incidental thing that the resources that you have are providing, but in fact are critical and that require investment, intentioned investment, that regulators need to pay attention to in order to accomplish our goals. So that's what Lies Beyond Capacity Markets is about. And it includes some thinking that I think, if you're here, you might find interesting. Thank you.
I should say everything. Our general policy is everything that we present here ends up posted on our website. You'll look at the agenda for today, and for each presenter, there'll be a link. So you didn't have to write down the whole email, the whole URL. You can get at it in the next couple of days. It'll be posted. And that's already on your site anyway, probably, yeah.
Yes, it's all on our site. And I should say that Mike Hogan, the primary author of this paper, is going to a California ISO, California PC workshop at the end of this month to talk about these issues, because in California they're saying energy market, capacity market, there are those who want to hear about different alternatives, which we're going to provide for them.
I was just going to ask if you could put the last slide up from like two ago, the decision framework tree. You flipped through it really quickly. Thanks. I don't have a question.
Okay, we can leave that up. Any other questions?
So, you know, your comment about the energy-only markets are a crisis waiting to happen sort of struck home. And I'm puzzled that 10 years later, FERC hasn't ordered load-serving energies to carry some sort of reserve margin to make sure that doesn't happen again. So I guess my question for you is, for your system to work, is there going to need to be some sort of standard established for these other forward capacity markets that you know, thou shalt have this amount of this kind of ancillary service in order to be deemed to be reliable, or do you think that it could work strictly on a market basis?
ISO New England is proceeding down a path that is not exactly what we've suggested, but similar to what we've suggested. What is the same is that they want to differentiate the capacity that wins in their auction. The way they're going about it is they're planning to create positive and negative incentives for being available at scarce times. And so... if you're available at scarce times, you'll get the capacity payment plus a bonus. If you're not available at scarce times, you will get the capacity payment minus a penalty, which could wipe out your capacity payment. And they're very clear that it makes a difference whether you're available at scarce times. Scarce times are driven increasingly by variable resources. And so... being able to invest to be prepared for that is going to become very important for the economics of generation in New England. And I think that's a leading-edge effort because the six New England states are united in their interest in getting ready for renewable resources, and so they have a political backing to take what is a pretty significant step here. A PJM, which is not as politically... consistent, has a similar capacity market, is not doing what ISO New England is doing, but is thinking about it.
Again, not Bruce Pearlstein, Navigant Consulting, not to be California-centric, but California is currently having
currently has a proceeding going on where the CAISO and the IUs are discussing the possibility of distinguishing several different types of resource adequacy capacity, generic capacity, flexible capacity, which provides load following and ramping services needed to integrate renewables, as well as possibly a resource adequacy requirement for ancillary services. And the debate right now eventually is going to lead to whether demand what degree demand response can provide both load following and ramping services, as well as ancillary services.
Thank you. I'll just take that as a comment. Are there other questions or comments? Knowing that lunch is just outside.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just say at the end of this that I mentioned the importance of the people who oversee the system, and so to some degree, this presentation is designed to motivate the regulators and the energy offices to think about how to guide their jurisdictions in a direction that it accommodates the public policies that you have, and it's not trivial. But it's also not impossible. And so I think it's really an encouragement to get with it. And with that, I think we'll break for lunch. We'll be back at 1 o'clock.
Let me just take a minute. Those of you who have paid, I think there are names on the bags. That's how they've done it in the past. I haven't actually seen this. Those of you who haven't paid, please see me, and we'll get everybody fed. One more thing. I didn't do this earlier because, I'm going to retire next month, and my replacement is here in the room. You should introduce yourself to Ben Quila, who's there against the side, and DR will be part of his job, not all of it. So introduce yourself to him. You'll get to know him, lunch.
I had 10 of these. Didn't bring a lot of them, but
yeah, okay. And you giving the rest of them all away?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're
looking
there, and they'll
get
right there.
Okay.
Okay. No, I just said I wanted to that kind of thing. I'm sure.
Okay, you got exact change, yes?
That's good. I only have 20.
Then I can give you. Thank you. No. Chad is out.
Okay. All right.
Our assistant. I didn't know what he was going to
add. Yeah. That was.
I don't know this person no longer works here.
I'm going to be
Well, so a little nudge is maybe what we can do from here, and we have people from the commission's listening. And oh yeah, but there's a lot of economic. There are going to be a lot of economic decisions made, and whether they're based on public interest values or not is really up to the regulators. Well, you need to move the regulators. I felt like I had a fairly good idea where the line was.
Or
So there wasn't this direct relationship to the greater spirit. So this is what happens in poison and now this origin.
Yeah, vertically
integrated. Right, they're vertically integrated, and it's all And one could argue, well, maybe
Yeah. I'm actually going to It's going to be the best presentation of the day.
I spared no expense.
Well, I knew that. I mean, I assumed that.
Make sure you don't let anybody leave. You've got to lock the door. And you're welcome to put it, yeah, on the website or whatever.
Okay.
It's nothing proprietary in it.
Which is it?
It's CEA. That one. Yeah, with the date.
You will be able to come to our
want to see if it opens, just make sure there's no glitches.
Yeah, that's it.
Your name came up in
earlier.
Well, yeah, it did,
yeah.
It did when.
Because somebody
when
says
Brian,
water heaters.
Yeah. And Isaiah said, okay, Isaiah said, you guys are doing a.
I'm going to mention that quickly.
And it's. It's a small dead band, or it's a small amount of storage. Kind of, you talk about it.
Yeah.
You don't have mixie valves.
Right.
135 max.
Just the tank right out of Lowe's.
Okay.
There's a picture of it.
Okay.
Now the one, and I have the disclaimer on it. The one that's at Lowe's that doesn't have. It's close to the CEA standard, but it's not the CEA standard.
Okay.
But it's got the socket, and we're plugging into it.
Okay. And that's part of the pilot.
Yeah.
These are all sockets operating. And you're using them both directions?
Yeah. Yes. Well, mostly for research purposes. The current power with boys is they're on a time and use rate. And they have a little slider switch that allows them, if they're getting too many warm showers, it allows them to move a slider for more comfort to more savings. So the more comfort gives them more hot water. And
let me get my apple for just a second.
But the pilot we're going to implement this year is going to be pretty much just direct load control. Just to make sure, and we'll be very conservative, just to make sure we're not interfering with customers.
So load control down.
Yeah. But I mean, you'll see there's a graphic that has the architecture. Basically, we have an open ADR server that's sending time of use price signals for direct load control events. And then the architecture such that the thing that plugs into the water heater is pinging that server frequently, like every 5 minutes, and asking, should I turn off? Should I turn off? It doesn't have anything better to do. And so eventually the status changes on the server. And it says, yeah, you should turn off. And then it tells the water heater to turn off.
If it's on.
If it's on, right. Yeah. But well, another one of my slides, this is all going to be 12 minutes, so this is going to go through really quick. It's going to create a ton of questions.
Well, where have we got you?
It's not a short take. I mean, I will do it in 12 months, if that's what we agree on. But,
excellent. You know, if there's a lot of interest, I'll give you my time.
Okay.
I'm after it.
Okay.
I'm the last. So if we really run out of time...
There's two things that you're doing.
I don't think I'll even do this.
Okay.
Because I haven't really cheated up very well on my slides or my own slides.
Trying to figure out what it looks like at the end of the day.
I'm just telling Conrad if he runs along, it's okay.
Just give Conrad the whole thing. Yeah. It's going to be the best one of the day.
Exactly. That's why I came. I missed the presentations at the Spark Tree class.
This is going to be good.
Hey. You could be a speaker at the Smart Grid. That's one thing you could do in retirement.
You don't know anything about Smart Grid.
You can talk about the economics of resources.
Yeah. I can do something about that.
There you go.
Or even,
the politics, not the politics, but the method of how the region goes about deciding what type of resources it needs. I mean, that's a worthwhile idea. You know?
We put out a plan, but shit, then everybody comes back and says, no.
Well, you're more influential than you're letting on. I mean, there is, it puts a big, line in the sand. The people that violate it have to account to God, I think. But,
They can argue to a regulator or something, and they may win.
Right.
Because they're arguing to the situation.
Right. Right. But, I mean, it's a very powerful, the whole history of the council and its influence and why, all of that is really fascinating stuff. And when you talk about the politics of making changes, all the precedents that are set and all the rural circles that go around, the whole NEA, the ETO, all of that stuff is really driven by the conference plan. And, they're all going to do their own thing. They're all their own organizations. But, it's driven by the plan. Anyhow, you can take more credit.
I'll argue we've had influence. I agree.
And for the most part, it's very good.
It's been a good place to work.
So, I gotta go. No, I gotta go to dinner. I'm gonna. What'd you say? Ben?
I think he pronounces it Kujala. It's Kujala. I think it's Finnish. And I've also heard it pronounced Kujala. I mean, it's where the accent is. Kujala or Kujala. I know other people really butcher it, but I've asked them a couple of times to try to say it right. I think it's clear. But I wouldn't.
So the accent on the first note?
Yeah. Or maybe there's no accent. I mean, there are languages where there isn't an accent. It's just kind of most languages.
And I'm horrible at getting
Well, it's Ben. But you'll be safe with Ben. Well, you don't need to introduce, but.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Yeah.
Okay, everyone, it's 1 o'clock. We've given you a nice break for lunch, and now please resume your seats so we can get started again. Yeah. We're going to send out the dogs in a minute. So this morning, we opened up the idea of the importance of ancillary services, the often overlooked family of services that actually do a lot to keep the lights on compared to capacity and energy. And so we're going to talk further about that this afternoon with two speakers. And you've heard from one of them through some good questions this morning, Bruce Pearlstein from Navigant, who's standing here, I think, raring to go, and Jason McDonald from LBNL, who's sitting over there,
yeah.
And so they've got some things teed up for us that Ken is going to put up while I fill time. And I think what you're seeing is a theme across the presentations today that integrating demand response into planning and thinking about all of its values is going to be increasingly imperative for regulators and their utilities. And Bruce, I'll let you say anything more about yourself in introduction, but I think we can get started. You're all queued up, so off you go. Why don't you pass me that mic
sure.
So in the walking around phase I can do that. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for giving me a chance to talk. But myself, I've been doing this for about 30-some-odd years. I'm not quite at Ken's point of retirement, but I'm getting there. Started out with NERA, worked at Authie Diddle, worked at a number of the big county firms, was out of my own for about 9 years, and then working mostly with PG&E down there, not the PGE up here, and been with Navigant now for going close to 2 years. What I'm going to talk about is what's going on in California. So not the Pacific Northwest, but it'll maybe give you some insights as to what might happen up here. Essentially, start out with a fact. The fact is that 29 states plus 2 U.S. territories already have renewables portfolio standards. Another 8 states plus 2 more territories have renewable portfolio goals. And those are usually expressed as requiring utilities to obtain a certain percentage of the retail kilowatt hour sales from renewable resources. And in California, that excludes large hydro resources. California has the second most ambitious target for renewable energy, 33% by 2020. And there's talk of raising that, and I heard the governor's advisor, energy advisor, talk about 80%. Most of us thought he was smoking something at the time. But they're talking about raising it in serious. Hawaii, which has a 40% target, we're working with right now to help them evaluate a DR program providing ancillary services. The point is that this is an issue throughout the United States right now. It's not going to go away. Oh, back to my... Where am I here?
I'm going.
Am I at the right place? Nope, wrong one. That one, sorry.
Nope, that's not it.
Or am I missing? I know, I'm looking for PowerPoint here.
Well, that's... Okay, sorry. I thought that was a PDF.
Let's see. There are two. Okay. Revealing my technological ignorance here.
Okay, let's just start over again.
Okay. While we're doing that, basically, let me just set the stage. And again, for most people, what I'm going to say might be familiar. Forgive me for that.
grid operators need to maintain the stability of the grid by maintaining a certain frequency. The challenge of maintaining grid stability on the within the hour is due to uncertainties created by the volatility demand, the variability of supply, and the uncertainty in forecasting both supply and demand over different time intervals. The more our jurisdiction relies on variable intermittent, primarily wind and solar power, the greater that challenge, and would result in steeper system ramping requirements, increased need for regulation, spinning reserve, and load following resources, more frequent and larger overgeneration events, and less efficient dispatch of conventional generation resources. So that's the stage for the next slide, if I can get stuck into the same thing here.
More.
I did that last time. Okay, good. In July 2012, I and some colleagues, including Eric Gilbert, who's sitting here in the room with us, completed a white paper evaluating the potential for using IOUDR programs to facilitate the integration of wind and solar energy needed to achieve California's RPS target. That report was prepared at the request of the statewide committee, Man Response Measurement and Evaluation Committee, which consists of representatives of California's three IOUs, Pacific Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, and the California Energy Commission, California PUC. That white paper, which is available with the link shown here, was basically aimed at policymakers and non-technical key stakeholders. And I apologize in advance because there were things we did not do in this paper because of that. But primarily it was to evaluate and identify the ability of the existing and the planned IDR resources of the IOUs to meet the renewable integration needs of the California ISO, to identify the changes that improve the ability of some of those programs to provide those services, and to evaluate and compare the ways other ISOs and some non-ISO utilities, including BPA, by the way, were planning to or already using DR resources to maintain grid stability and or integrate variable renewable energy. California, in order to achieve its goal of 33% RPS, is going to have to increase its reliance on wind and solar. The bulk of the resources that will be used to achieve that goal will be wind and solar, and therefore intermittent. By 2011, on average, the three California IOUs already had reached over 20%, which was the goal for that year. Rather 2010, of obtaining that much renewable energy from RPS eligible resources, again excluding large hydro. As they go toward 33%, that need is going to grow for those resources capable of managing grid stability. Usually, outside of areas with a lot of hydro, those services are provided by conventional quick-start fossil fuel generation capacity, mostly quick-start CTs. In California, the concern was that a fair chunk of that capacity is going to disappear because the state has ordered plants that use once-through cooling to either shut down or retrofit to eliminate, convert from once-through cooling. And there's going to be retirement of over 12,000 megawatts of once-through cooling power plant capacity by 2017. That includes 17 fossil fuel power plants on the coast, as well as California's two nuclear power plants. Now, in California, we have long-term procurement plan proceedings where every 2 years, the CPUC conducts a proceeding in which they decide how much capacity they will authorize each utility to procure and what types. In this latest proceeding that began in 2010, they divided into several tracks. Track two was what are the long-term procurement plans the utilities will be authorized to pursue for their bundled customers. But in track one, it was supposed to determine how much and whether and how much additional
new renewable integration capacity to be needed to manage grid stability by 2020. Now, in California, and this is not in the presentation, we have a surplus of capacity right now. Capacity is very, very cheap. That's going to change once those, once the cooling plants are shut down. The CAISO is primarily concerned about maintaining the reliability of the system and therefore wants to, has an objective of adding more and more capacity. The IOUs, because they're rate-based regulated, have an economic incentive to do the same. The CPUC is an objective of trying to serve customers at the lowest cost, reliably. And a lot of interveners are also concerned about the cost of adding additional capacity. So that sets the stage for what happened. And in that proceeding, by July 2012, they still hadn't reached a determination of how much new capacity we needed to provide renewable integration services. They had estimates of how much capacity they needed, but not how much it would be new. In other ISOs and RTOs, they've begun using demand response to provide those services. And my panel colleague from LVNL will talk more about that in a more detailed survey than we did. But they primarily concentrated on demonstrating DR's ability to provide the services and removing barriers to increase DR participation in wholesale and service markets. And again, California has wholesale market for energy services, wholesale market for ancillary services. Right, it was only in the last 2 years that the CAISO established rules approved by the FERC to allow DR resources to bid directly into those markets. They have not yet established rules for allowing DR resources to bid directly into wholesale markets for ancillary services. And one peculiarity of this, most of the capacity that's provided by aggregators in California is provided under bilateral contracts to the IOUs. Well, if they start bidding their capacity into wholesale energy markets and wholesale and ancillary services markets, they're going to be bidding against, perhaps, IOUs who provide the bulk of their revenues on these bilateral contracts for capacity the utilities need to satisfy the resource adequacy requirements. Other jurisdictions vary quite a bit, but most have taken a cautious approach to using DR resources to provide ancillary services. Most of them began with pilot programs or limiting the portion of balancing services provided by DR resources. Over time, in some of those jurisdictions, DR resources that demonstrate that they can provide the services with sufficient reliability and precision have been permitted to provide a larger portion of those ancillary services, particularly in PJM. This table here summarizes what we found generically. There's a lot more detail in the white paper and the appendix to the white paper on this. But in essence, what we found was that except for the California ISO, most other jurisdictions were already doing this, at least on a pilot basis or on a full-time basis. We also looked at EPA, obviously, and Hawaiian Electric, not so incidentally because they're an island system, have a 40% renewable energy target, and are island systems, therefore can't rely on imports to maintain the stability of their networks, and therefore protect and have very, very ambitious renewable energy targets under a settlement with federal government, the state, and various interveners. Now, one thing that I think it's useful to keep in mind, and frankly, not many people on the DR side in California thought about this, though the information is obviously public, is that total cost of ancillary service in California was only about 1.9% of the total wholesale cost of energy delivered in California in 2011. Up from just 1% in 2010. That $139 million total includes the cost of services that were purchased in CAISO's wholesale energy market, ancillary services market, as well as roughly $30-some-odd million value of the ancillary services that IOUs provided for themselves. it's likely that these percentages will increase as the need for ancillary service increases, but not necessarily if there's an additional capacity, supply and demand. So we're not talking about a lot of dollars here in terms of revenues for DR to go after. CAISO basically uses four types of ancillary services. Say, spinning reserve, non-spinning reserve, or supplemental reserve, it's sometimes called. And then they distinguish between regulation up and regulation down as two different services. Most other jurisdictions don't distinguish that. For DR, that's important, because in the absence of being coupled with energy storage, it's hard for DR resources to provide an offset or to provide increased load to offset the need for regulation down. I think I'm getting it right. I always get this confused back and forth. Now, what's going on, and I alluded to this earlier in my comments, the CAISO in the middle of this was proposing that the CPUC require the IOUs to maintain not only enough generic capacity to meet their resource adequacy requirements, but also flexible capacity. And that flexible capacity had to meet certain numerical attributes with regard to the ability to maintain maximum continuous ramping and load following ramping capability. They had not been procuring those resources before, and they are the ones responsible for maintaining stability of the grid. So all this was going on while we're preparing the white paper. And before I talk to this slide, as I mentioned earlier, what they were also proposing is to distinguish between not only the capacity utilities required to meet the resource adequacy requirements for generic purposes and flexible capacity, but also requiring utilities to maintain a certain amount of ancillary services capacity. And that debate is still going on right now. It hasn't finished. What we did in the study was we used the technical attributes from the CAISO's ancillary service tariffs to evaluate the potential ability of each IUDR program to provide renewable energy integration services. And basically, there were five attributes. How much advance notice of deployment could the resource get? Obviously, in most cases, less than most DR programs now provide. Second, how quickly can they respond to a control signal? Usually, receipt of a dispatch signal from California ISO. The duration of the response. What was the amount of time for which the resource must be able to provide the service each time it's dispatched? Frequency of response. Ancillary services resources are dispatched far more frequently than traditional capacity DR resources, as we all know, and more frequently even than economic DR resources are dispatched to avoid hot hours in which wholesale prices are unusually high for energy. Finally, and very importantly, there's a requirement for reliability. What is the range of permissible deviation between the amount of product, amount of service the resource was scheduled to deliver and the amount that was actually delivered, which in California terminology is referred to as an uninstructed deviation. And although this slide is probably difficult to read, basically it summarizes what those requirements were for each of the ancillary services that the CAISO currently procures, as well as, to the extent that we had them at that point, what those attributes were for the load following continuous ramping products that the CAISO was trying to develop in the stakeholder process. And again, I apologize for the slide. It's probably familiar to most of you. You can divide DR resources into emergency reliability capacity products, usually dispatched with more advanced notice than other products. Obviously, that's where DR started out historically as a way to avoid brownouts, shutdowns. Then there are economic DR resources. Ones are dispatched based on market prices or market heat rates.
I have the market price of energy divided by the market price of gas. Quicker response times are needed, but still not as fast as ancillary services. And then we get to the bottom of that triangle where we're talking about ancillary services. The least demanding in terms of time, the dispatch, are obviously non-synchronous, non-spinning reserves. You're not dispatching them, but they have to be available. Synchronous spinning reserves, obviously running units running at a low level, but still synchronized with the grid. And finally, toughest of all, and fewest of all, in terms of DR programs, regulation up or down. There were a few key factors we found that affect the potential liability of your resources to provide those services. Automation. Without automation, it's hard to envision a DR program providing ancillary services. Second, the types of end uses that are enrolled in the programs, the characteristics and availability of those end use loads play a key role in determining whether or not you provide ancillary services. If you're dispatching something in California, it would be air conditioning. You can't provide ancillary services at night for direct load control of customers' air conditioners. Second, to some degree, location of loads providing ancillary services. And here I'm going to get out of my depth because I'm not an engineer. But there are certain local grid reliability needs. And the CAISO is now requiring, or the CPU now requires, all your resources to be dispatchable on a locational basis, not just generically across the entire service territory. Finally, reliability. You've got to be able to deliver the amount of resource, amount of the service that you were dispatched to provide with very little very little tolerance for deviations from that amount. What do we find? Well, on average, we conclude that most of the DR programs have only limited ability to provide renewable energy integration services. And imagine trying to tell that to your clients who are IOUs. They do come closest, on average, to achieving the required duration response, which isn't surprising because DR programs have generally been used for liability and economic purposes, and those events usually last for longer than an ancillary service event, so to speak. Second, the frequency with which those DR programs can be dispatched is also a significant limitation, because most, under the current program rules, can't be dispatched more than once per day, no more than roughly 12 to 15 times a year, whereas ancillary service resources can be dispatched 100, 200 times a year. The amount of advance notice requirement, again, that's a significant limitation. Most DR programs require a significant amount of advance notice, especially if they're manually initiated. Response to a phone call and email, you still have to have a manual initiation unless you have automated load control, auto DR. Finally, again, maximum permitted deviation reliability is a difficult standard for programs to achieve, particularly those programs that do not rely on automation, but rather rely on behavioral responses, manual initiation. California has invested a lot in annually estimating, using econometric models, the load impacts that DR resources provided during the past year, during DR events, as well as using those same regression models to predict how much load reductions would, what the magnitude of load reductions would be if those programs were dispatched on future monthly peak load days under a standard set of event day conditions, either 1 in 10 or 1 in 2 weather conditions. And the uncertainty surrounding those econometric estimates also must be reported. So think about, you have a determinist, you have a single point estimate of how much load reduction will be delivered by a particular program in a particular region, maybe even a particular NICS code, industry code, and then the probability distribution of that load impact. And California reporting requires that IOUs report the 10th, 30th, 50th, 70th, and 90th percentile of that probability distribution. And sometimes that probability distribution is very wide, and obviously for automated programs, it's usually far smaller. On average, the current DR programs have a limited ability to provide these services. And these graphs on the left summarize the average ability of those programs to meet each of those required attributes for regulation, spinning, and non-spin. On the right, the summation across all those programs
to provide non-spin, spinning, and regulation services. And basically, it's a very simplistic ranking system we used. We weren't asked to do anything specific. We'd love to have done something more specific, but at this stage, they're just trying to learn about this and get some sense of what makes sense. The key modifications that we needed are telemetry for real-time communications, metering control, reduced or no advanced notification time, automated response to control signals, and increasing the number of times and the frequency with which the DO resources can be dispatched. Now, some of those modifications would obviously discourage customers from participating in those programs. Others would fundamentally alter the nature of the existing programs. If the changes are adopted, however, five of the current programs might be able to meet all the CAISO requirements for non-spinning reserves. Four might meet the requirements for spinning reserves. Three might also meet CAISO requirements for regulation services. Now, if modified DO resources provide ancillary services identical to those provided by quick start generation capacity, and importantly, are believed to do so, that's an important caveat I'll get to in a moment, then the degree to which those DO resources will be used to provide those services will depend on largely the relative cost of using DO resources versus quick start generation capacity to provide those services, as well as supply and demand conditions in CAISO's wholesale markets for ancillary services. And I said, I emphasized, I believe to be able to do that because most grid operators, most resource planners, most people in utilities don't believe that DO resources can do that. If they already ensure DO resources provide emergency services or can provide economic DR. There's a lot of skepticism about this for a whole lot of reasons that all of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. This is going to be a big barrier for using DO resources to provide ancillary services where the technical requirements are even more stringent. These are some of the programs that could provide the services with the modifications, and I won't go into them, some of them from you too, if you have. Want more details, we haven't talked to you, heard of the white paper. These are the same graphs as I showed you before, but now showing what would be the programs we'd be able to do after the modifications. You could also design new DR programs to provide those services, but they would have to have certain characteristics summarized here. In terms of telemetry and response time, automated response, event initiation, availability, and target end uses for those programs. And I'm pretty much toward the end of my time. There's more here. I won't go into it. Basically, we went through what are the obstacles to using DR for ancillary service, and then some next steps we recommended that that committee commission projects to look into, including potential cost effectiveness, automation, coordination with other DR programs, et cetera. And with that, I'll stop and thank you. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
So we'll entertain questions, but I'm going to ask you a question keying off of what I talked about before, which is you're thinking about assuming there becomes some acceptance that all this is valuable, how do you motivate investment in these directions? Have you thought that far ahead?
I'm a market guy. If you have a wholesale and service market, the market will give the price signals. People will respond. The question is setting up the rules under which they can participate. The biggest problem is going to be that DR programs basically get most of their benefit. If you're an aggregator, you get most of your profits from selling capacity. But if you sell capacity, that while you're selling that capacity, it's not available to provide ancillary services. That's one of the obstacles we talked about in later slides. Second, to what degree can you bid into wholesale markets for ancillary services when you may be bidding against DR programs that are run by IOUs, bidding into the same markets, and you're competing against your customers? Big problem. Now, maybe you guys don't have it up here because you don't have an organized wholesale market for ancillary services. But the issue still exists, especially if you use aggregators. There are other issues. There are some IOUs who are arguing right now with the CAISO and CPC that they shouldn't be required to bid in their DR resources in order to qualify for resource adequacy. Rather, they should be allowed to bid in as reductions in demand. The way they are actually being used now for resource planning purposes, You forecast your load, forecast demand, you reduce it by the peak loads by the estimates of the DR reduction capacity will be available, a load reduction capacity in those peak, monthly peak load days, and you plan against that. On a more operational basis, you assume that the programs could provide so much reduction capacity, and you can use the models, the econometric models, to predict how much would be provided at a given time. And some of the IOUs are beginning to use the same models they used to estimate the load impacts, to estimate that on a real-time operational basis as well as for marketing. One other thing I say is that one of the most undeveloped areas in DR is forecasting enrollments in these programs. When you have an existing program that's been stable around for a long time, that's not as much of a big problem. We're talking about a new program. Particularly, let's say in California, they institute dynamic, mandatory dynamic pricing programs. All customers, all non-residential customers, are automatically, have now been automatically defaulted to so-called dynamic pricing, or CPP, the kind I described earlier, high, super high prices during events, offset by credits against the rates you would, TOU rates you would otherwise pay in those hours. Forecasting the number of customers would opt out to TOU rates rather than remain on the program, that was a big challenge. Now, some of us, and I was one of them, we developed econometric models, discrete choice models, to predict customer behavior, both enrolling in those programs and other programs. We did that first based on historical behavior. In some cases, we had a new program, we had to do it based on surveys, what customers said they would do, and then later on it turned out what they said they would do was not what they actually did. We estimate the models to produce no load forecast. But that's a big issue. And one of the things you can get out of those models is what kind of price incentive do you have to give to customers to get them to participate in the programs? How much does price make a difference when they're willing to participate? How much difference does it make if you say you can choose to be exposed 8 hours or 4 hours or X number of days or Y number of days of being dispatched? Well, using that information, you could design the programs to attract more customers into the program. Well, thank you. I think
we'll have our next speaker, and if we have any questions occur before the end of the day, we can ask Bruce. Can you want to queue up slides?
All right, my name is Jason McDonald. I'm with the Grin Integration Group at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Unlike a lot of previous speakers, I've only been in the industry for about 15 months now, so I got a lot to learn from all of you. So what I'm going to be talking about in a similar vein is comparing the opportunities and challenges in the different wholesale markets. And the reason why, I mean, wholesale markets isn't really as valuable to you guys here, but at least you can get an idea of what the value of ancillary services might be in those markets, and maybe extrapolate that into some sort of tariff structure, something you could use to bring customers in here. And also the technical requirements of those ancillary services and in those markets, and how some are going about opening up the markets to get more participants. I'll introduce wholesale market. A lot of this I'll probably skim through. We've talked about it some already. But going in, looking at value in the markets, both in market clearing prices and the market sizes across the country, and then some of the market rules that affect DR participation. And this is an ISO-centric presentation, so it's really lacking some of the additional barrier. And I think the initial thought was we were looking at doing pilot projects in DR to provide ancillary services. And initially, I think the thought was that, well, these markets are more open. It'll be easier to get a project going. I think that there might be some personally, some challenges when you've got additional entities that you've got to deal with. In a vertically integrated utility, we might be able to get a pilot going a lot faster because we only have to get the vertically integrated utility involved versus this. I'm looking at ISOs and the open markets there, but I'm not taking into account the retail environments. And if I'm using a demand-side resource, I've got to get everybody in line to get involved. We all know what ISO RTO markets are. All right. The ancillary services that I'm going to focus on here are frequency regulation and spinning reserve, because they're considerably more valuable than the non-spinning reserve and in other markets supplemental reserve. I think we all know what frequency reserve. We've heard now what frequency reserve frequency regulation and spinning reserve are. So I don't need to explain that. But one thing to keep in mind is these are you're paid in units of capacity held for an hour. So this megawatt-hour is a unit that sometimes confuses people. It's not a megawatt-hour. It's a megawatt held for an hour. Why are we interested in demand response for ancillary services? And we've talked about this already today. It's really there could be very fast, flexible resources. In a market situation, they'd be cheaper than they'll probably be coming into a market as price taker in most cases, and so they'll be cheaper to operate. And something that we haven't mentioned explicitly, I think, is the statistical reliability of these large aggregations of small resources. That would really be, once they're in the market, I mean, you have to get the participation up, but once you've got that participation in the market, you really have a more reliable resource than, say, your one large generator. If you're planning for a single contingency, the single contingency in that aggregation is pretty negligible. They're also fast to market, and this is kind of, you know, looking at that Idaho case, really. They brought these DR, well, maybe, I mean, but it's interesting that DR can come into the market really quickly, a lot faster than a traditional generator might. You don't have the siting and permitting issues and things like that. So that there's advantages there. It might also be a disadvantage because you don't have the investment essentially into the resource. They're a controllable, or potentially a controllable if automated, and a controllable and distributed resource near the load, which can be valuable. Market clearing prices. We probably, most of us here, know what a market clearing price is. Really quickly, there's a resource cost curve. In ancillary services world, that's an availability bid plus the opportunity cost of the generator, in this case, not providing energy and instead holding its capacity in reserve. And those are summed together. Then wherever the required ancillary service capacity is, that whatever the marginal unit or marginal increment of additional capacity sets the market clearing price, whatever that would be. And that market clearing price is paid to all the resources in a market like this, regardless of what your actual costs are. Everything that's economic, anyway. So very quickly looking at all of the ISO RTOs that run ancillary service markets, we can see market clearing prices for both regulation and spinning reserve. You'll notice there's these kind of red lines in the Cal ISO, and it might be really kind of small in this, but red lines and Cal ISO and ERCOT, that's because they split, as we heard, they split regulation into two separate products, an up and a down regulation, which you can be paid for both at the same time. And other places, you're required to have a symmetric response, both up and down, and so you're paid a single price for that symmetric response. Regulation is considerably, they're both on the same axis, so regulation is considerably more valuable than spinning reserve. And one thing to note, though, is these average prices that I'm showing here are annual average prices. There's variability throughout the year in markets, which makes a lot of sense. And it's not trends that you see don't necessarily reflect overall trends if you look at monthly averages. So the lower curves,
show those monthly averages. And you look at, for example, California ISO's South's reserve zone spinning reserve price. There's some kind of a seasonal effect that we're seeing from 2009 through 2011. But there isn't really a clear overall trend, which is you might take away that, you know, it's trending up. If, I mean, 2 years is not enough to notice a trend, but in other cases you might take away that trend. Really, that big price spike in 2011 is because there was it was a really wet year. And so all the hydro that would normally be in the ancillary services markets was providing energy at, you know, full capacity. So they couldn't provide ancillary services, and the price went up. The opposite is true in New York ISO, where you see the seasonal effects of both these peaks in winter and summer, but there is an overall trend down, and has been. What becomes even more interesting, and especially to demand response in these type of markets, is daily trends. There's opportunity for some types of loads to really capture high prices throughout the course of a day. These are upregulation prices in two different winter and summer in California. And you're seeing, you know, in summertime, it's got a piece... upregulation and spinning reserve both kind of reflect the shape of the load a little bit and prices in California and in other places. So if you look at something like a cooling load, it really has an opportunity maybe to capture some of that high value ancillary services, which could be interesting for business models for aggregators and such. If you look at I don't have it showed here, but downregulation has an opposite trend where it's more valuable in the early morning and much less valuable in the afternoon. So you might be using a different load for that in your portfolio. So now talking about a little bit about market size, there's two ways I was thinking of market size, both in the actual megawatts that are procured for ancillary services, and the relative megawatts, I should say, and the dollars in the markets. We've got a typical rule of thumb, I guess, in a lot of places is 1% of regulation of your load is per regulation, or I've heard that enough, and three or four, maybe up to 5% for spinning reserve. And so these are the ISO RCOs where I could actually gather data on what their procurement in their markets was. This doesn't reflect any self-scheduled or bilateral contracted out-of-market type of procurements. But you can see it is, as a percentage of load, it's relatively small on this 0.6 to, in ERCOT's case, because they're an isolated system, they're procuring more ancillary services than the other three. And in terms of dollars, California ISO this is in millions of dollars per year in this table here, and it's regulation in $24 million a year is how much is spent in the market. Outside of the market, there's other procurement. I think California ISO tended to be 70% of ancillary service procurement for these years was in the market, but it's not a lot of money. It's not enough to support a lot of businesses anyway getting into this, and it's certainly there's certainly money here. I mean, there's over $100 million in ERCOT and PJM per year, and definitely. Something to consider as part of the portfolio, but I think that it's not something that can support industry on its own necessarily, large industry anyway. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about some market rules that affect DR participation, things that are keeping DR from being involved. It's fundamentally DR resources are much smaller than traditional generators, it's obvious, and so they need to be allowed to enter the market at a lower level. ISO RTOs used to have rules that were, you know, minimum size of 1 megawatt, and a lot of that had to do with significant digits in their back-end software. And so opening up that software now, especially with more advanced computing and more powerful computing, being able to crunch more smaller numbers allows you to get more resources in and opens it up to DR. Allowing aggregation of resources, which when I say aggregation, I mean a lot, bunch of different demand response resources behind separate meters, and being the resource being aggregated at the you know, the transmission level, and treated in the system as an aggregate. That in most cases is not really allowed for regulation specifically, because they require special networks connections directly to provide the AGC signals and whatnot. And this, and none of this is, doesn't make sense, but it's a something that could be looked at and perhaps adjusted for more DR participation. And last here, I've got there's requirements, especially which may be strange in some cases, for requiring full power response for a certain length of time when you're providing regulation, for instance. That's not necessarily in CAISO and MISO, they require that to be certified to provide regulation, you have to be able to provide it for that power output for an hour, rather than being asked to follow a signal that represents regulation and up to a certain level. And you know, so those kind of things could at least be examined in more detail and seeing if they're truly necessary. There's additional market rules that affect, the first ones really affect participation levels. And there's others that I didn't get into at all. I just put a few down. But these are affect the cost effectiveness of DR. Measurement and verification is especially in the ancillary services, can be very challenging, very cumbersome. Providing telemetry is absolutely necessary for regulation at some level, but maybe some statistical measures for statistical measurement might be appropriate for an aggregation of small resources, say. So here I've got, you know, I mentioned that the accuracy requirements are different between revenue metering and telemetry, telemetry generally being easier. You're using, with DR resources, you're typically going to try to use the same meter, so it's the revenue meter that's limiting, so that's why I have it listed. And then spinning reserve, requiring telemetry for spinning reserve is something that in the case of both PJM and ERCOT to some extent. ERCOT is a strange case because they actually have a lot of DR participation in spinning reserves, but it's a kind of a legacy system thing where they've got demand response on under frequency relays, and that existed before the formal markets. And so they brought it in as spinning reserve, but that it just drops out at a different frequency. So it's frequency responsive. But the controllable resources, of which there is only one in their market, is required to have telemetry, even if it's providing spinning reserve. PJM does not require telemetry for spinning reserve, but their system is not necessarily automated. So they have it's automated in that a phone call is automatically sent out saying you need to provide spinning reserve, and they expect you to do it within 10 minutes. But it is it's a phone call. So they're looking at moving that to DMP3 or something like that, automatic signal. And then this last thing here is a data source level. So in some cases, asking data to come all the way from, you know, each metered entity and be provided to the ISO is not something, or to the system operator, is not something that the system operator necessarily wants. They probably don't want to see all of the air conditioners in their, or whatever it is, water heaters in their system providing ancillary services. They may require that that data exist and be held somewhere. And in New York ISO, for example, they ask resources to, while you send them an aggregate, you have to have all of the six-second telemetry data for every resource in the aggregation for spinning reserve and hold that data for 6 years, I guess, for auditing, which is a pretty cumbersome requirement and can be kind of expensive. So the concluding remarks, there's really a wide range of ancillary service values in ISO RTOs. We saw that average price for regulation anywhere between $7 and $35. And the markets were pretty thin, not necessarily really large. The most favorable places from an ISO, from a wholesale market perspective, are to do this would be PJM and ERCOT. And so PJM I think PJM is the one that actually has more resources in, Enbala is pretty active there in the regulation markets. And there's others. It's not just Enbala doing regulation with demand response. And they have, in fact, had to increase the cap on the amount of demand response in the spinning reserve market because they were approaching that cap too quickly. PJM is probably the most favorable because ERCOT, the challenge there is the retail market. Because the retail market is so wide open, it's hard to get investment. If you can only hold a customer for 2 years at most, it's difficult to put in any investment into the infrastructure to enable demand response, especially automated demand response, which is absolutely necessary, essentially, for ancillary services. And as far as rules go, the first steps are really to allow smaller resources into the market and allow aggregation, especially for those really reliable, statistically reliable resources that you're looking for. Ancillary services really is going to need to be, as far as from a business development standpoint, it's going to need to be part of a portfolio of things that even maybe a single resource can provide, because there isn't maybe quite enough money in those markets. And even in the market clearing price to support the service. Other things I'll just quickly mention. So this was something that I gave at the Grid Interop conference, and what Andy Satchwell, who works with me and has probably been here a couple of times, I think, suggested I come and talk about. But we're trying to do some pilots as well, and I've done some recent work on really going into much more detail on the more holistically about the barriers for demand response and ancillary services, and that work is forthcoming. So if you're interested, you can let me know, and I'll make sure you get some of that.
Questions?
Great.
Okay, Howard.
Well, my questions were actually for both presentations. I didn't see any kind of absolute quantities here. How much demand response is being bid in, and what percent of the potential do you think we've realized so far, and what is the potential, or how much work has been there, has been done on that, if all the conditions that have been established were actually achieved?
It's a great question. I don't know numbers for current participation. It's not something that I've seen available exactly. I've sent some emails to that effect, and it's but I have not gotten the response I'm looking for. As far as work trying to examine the potential of Lowe's to provide these services and what the absolute potential might be, there the barriers assessment I mentioned earlier is part of a larger DOE-funded study from the EERE, and they're doing a production cost model of WEC and looking at a balancing authority level what the potential for demand response in five products is at going all the way on to end uses, but aggregating to the balancing authority. And so, and those five products include regulation and operating reserves, both spinning and non-spinning, and so, and then typical DR products. So that, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I can certainly get them to you if you'd like.
Howard, there's some references. FERC has collected a lot of information about demand response in terms of inventory. There's something relatively new called the National Action Plan for Demand Response that DOE has organized. I think part of the problem with this is not being sure how the technology and the markets are going to develop to deal with the theoretical potential. You know, this is one of those bullseye potential study things where how close to theoretical can the economic get if institutions and technology develop. There's a lot of contingencies there. I'm going to, Bruce, do you want to say something in response to this? Since you were invited, let me bring this over to you.
The answers to your questions in terms of the CAISO are A, DR does not participate now in the answer service market at all. The three IOUs have, at the request of the PUC, proposed ancillary service pilot programs. The ECPUC, which said it was going to act on them soon, then took 150 days to take a decision, and then took and then still hasn't met its deadline. So right now, DR doesn't participate in ancillary services at all. As far as the potential concerns, and I know about the first national DR study, since at least the data for California came from what we were doing at PG&E in those days, and SE in San Diego. The problem is, yes, in terms of what's cost-effective, i.e. economic, it's easy to estimate what technical potential is. But even harder problem is how much of it is commercially feasible.
Right.
Because you're predicting what customers will do. And frankly, that's the area in which we know the least, and the least research has been done on a macro level as opposed to a micro level particular program.
I had a question about the prices. I have trouble understanding them.
Sure.
It seems to me that it's an option where there would be a reservation fee and then a strike price, but it seems to be always couched in terms of this dollars per megawatt hour.
Yep.
So help me understand, is there a payment for just showing up in an hour, or you only get paid if you're actually dispatched, and you only get paid on the energy that you're dispatched?
You're paid if you're cleared, and it's a capacity payment. So this is capacity held for 1 hour, these prices, and they're done hourly. I mean, they're done hourly, as you get closer to real time, they can redispatch, and sometimes there's a 15-minute or 30-minute payment period. But you're paid whether or not you're used. You are settled on, in most cases. Demand response isn't always settled on energy, and ERCOT, they don't have to. You would be, generator is settled on the energy that it provides as well. But that's settled at the real-time price.
Real-time I feel LNP. Like I heard two things. You get paid if
you're always
cleared.
Always paid capacity if you're cleared.
And sometimes you get paid for energy.
And if you're called, then you'll be paid for the energy as well. And something to note is these regulation prices are representative from before, but as pay-per-performance, the FERC 755 rule is implemented, they'll be moving to a system more like, and this might actually be why the ISO New England shows up so small, as ISO New England has had a method of paying for the mileage payments, and that's not included in this. So the more that you're moved in regulation anyway, you'll be paid for that movement up or down. So there'll be a mileage clearing price, and then you're paid on how much you're used, and then a capacity, which you're paid for each hour you're held in reserve.
So what's shown here is a melding of the...
Well, that hasn't been implemented yet. That's a new rule it has been implemented in some organ in 2012 or late 2012. PJM got it going, and ISO New England has had it for a long time, but it is not shown here.
The answer to your question for CAISO was actually available on the CAISO website. And the actual payment, in the past at least, has varied depending on the service. In the case of a service where you're held in reserve, you not only get a capacity payment, but you also get paid for the gross margin you would have earned had you dispatched the unit and sold energy.
But that's included in the market clearing price.
Yeah, they're expressed in different ways, and actually for different programs. One, you're really selling capacity. The other, you're actually selling energy plus capacity. And it does vary. And the way the units are expressed varies from... the prices are actually determined varies from one service to the other in CAISO. I refer you to the CAISO website or look at the white paper because we have tables showing the amounts reported by year, by season, for each of these services over the last, I think, 4 or 5 years.
Would either of you like to speculate how much longer aggregators in California are going to be stuck in bilateral IOU contracts?
First of all, there was a new procurement, at least by PG&E, for I think 5 years contracts. I don't think SCE has announced a procurement yet. Part of the holdup is the CPUC didn't authorize them to go ahead. And part of the reason the CPUC did that is because they weren't quite clear as to how the CAISO markets would be restructured, in part because of FERC orders, in part because of other things. It is likely that aggregators will continue to provide a significant amount of DR capacity in California, whether they provide it through bilateral contracts or by bidding directly into markets is a question. My bet is it's going to be through bilateral contracts, because otherwise they'd be competing against the same people whom they're selling capacity.
Brad, get in on this.
Both PG&E and SCE awarded 2-year contracts recently, so the contracts with aggregators now go through 2014.
May is our season. We don't make a decision by now. We're going to be out of here. That's a CPC case to limit that and authorize procurements. That's only 2 years. We did authorize procurements beyond that. And the DR programs in California authorized a 3-year cycle. So 2013, I think the next cycle is 2016 to 17. And the procurements that have been authorized to make the contracts they're going to make.
Okay, California details. Are there other questions generally about the at a policy level that we can get to?
Yeah, a question on the phone.
Just a moment on the phone.
So you mentioned this is California-centric, so if you don't know the answer, that's fine. I'm guessing somebody else in the room here does. But early on, you mentioned that the regulation tended to be the most valuable product, followed by spinning, and the other two products were less spinning. You know, my recollection, and I was trying to find the exact numbers on the web here to get my question right, is that for Bonneville's verbs rate, it's the other way around, with the energy imbalance, sort of the slowest time response being the most expensive component of the rate and the regulation being less. And so,
well,
can anyone comment? Is it just because
I can't make a comment
as a hydro-based resource?
Let Ken might be familiar with this.
I think if you look in the guts of the rate case, you'll find that the products are priced the same. They're charged differently because wind uses more of the longer time span product than the shorter one. But I think when they allocate, you know, so the hour long is the biggest consumer of that product, but they actually charge the same amount per kilowatt.
Thank you.
Ed, we'll take somebody
the question from the phone.
Yeah, thanks. This is Russ at Flathead. I had a question on the slide on accuracy of telemetry and revenue quality metering.
Yes.
So I'm familiar with the revenue metering accuracy standards. Are there standards for telemetry accuracy or rates?
I'm not sure about standards, but I do know that they have a different requirement from the ISO, which is generally easier, or at least of the few ISOs that I know.
Okay, thanks.
I think it's time for a short break. Thanks to the presenters. And we'll start up again in about 10 minutes. So